The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here. Today
FM. It's time for our weekly Last Word on the Environment Spot. John Gibbons is with us as ever. And John, tell us about this new McPlant burger, which is going to be offered by McDonald's.
Good afternoon, Matt. Yes, this is certainly big news. What they're planning to do, and they've co-developed it with a company called Beyond Meat, which a lot of people will have heard of. This is one of these technology companies that that has made a huge splash and has attracted multi-billion dollar investment. So it's probably seen as one of the coming trends of the 2020s and beyond. And McDonald's obviously signing up to this is a massive change, because obviously they're one of the largest meat buyers in the world. In fact, one calculation says that McDonald's buy an average of 1.6 billion pounds of beef per annum. So when McDonald's makes a strategic decision like this, then obviously that's big news for the industry. It doesn't mean, of course, that McDonald's are exiting the selling beef-based beef burgers, but what it means really in the future is that they're going to have a quality alternative to beef burgers. As you know, some veggie burgers, as they're called to date, they're not great. They're really not that good. Now, I've had one of these Beyond Meat burgers, and quite honestly, they're indistinguishable to the untrained palate like myself from your typical patty of a beef burger, whether it's a McDonald's or whether it's a Burger King. Because to be honest, the beef used in those burgers, the beef itself is fine, but essentially you're not really tasting it. You're tasting the gherkin, you're tasting other things. So the beef is a very small part of the beef burger. So from the point of view of companies like McDonald's, they're well aware that there's a huge carbon impact and a huge climate impact connected with livestock agriculture. And they're getting a lot of pressure from investors, from the public as well, to say, you know, are you part of this problem? Are you moving on? And I think this is why we're now seeing a significant investment in this. And I suppose the proof of the pudding, or the proof of the patty, Matt, will be in the eating. And that is, will people accept these?
I'd imagine a lot of Irish farmers will be concerned, because McDonald's is a major buyer of Irish beef. We won't get into that. I want to get into what's in this meat-free patty that tastes like meat. What are the ingredients?
Well, of course, McDonald's aren't going to tell you exactly how it's put together. That would be their secret sauce. So I'm not able to tell you exactly how they put them together. But essentially, it's a plant-based ingredient. They're not going to tell us exactly how they put them together.
There were reports that Beyond Meat, that previously they had done one made of yellow peas, coconut, potato and beetroot juice.
Yeah, that's quite possible. I think they can synthesize burgers, or the sort of burger alikes, from all kinds of different products. So I suppose the question really remains is, will the public find them acceptable? Will, you know, is this the direction of travel for fast food companies? I know, for example, that Burger King, the alternate burger chain, they already have, and they advertise it quite heavily, a beef-free quarter pounder, or whatever their equivalent of quarter pounder is. And I've tried it, and it's as good or as bad as the meat-based equivalent. I make that point, Matt, there isn't really all that much of a meaty taste in burgers. And it often occurred to me that it's a scandalous use or misuse of a valuable, what should be a high-quality product, is to turn cattle into beef burgers. I mean, turn them into steaks, and, you know, sirloin steaks and sizzling steaks, fine. In other words, high value, high quality product. But grinding them up into burgers that nobody can tell the difference, to me, that always struck me as a very sad end, if you like, for beef burgers. And you would hope.
And one last thing on this, John. Apparently, it's not going to be marketed as a vegan product.
No, I mean, they're producing it to vegan standards. I noticed that, for example, they're using separate implements, etc. All the mustards and ketchups, everything is going to be done down the vegan thing. But I gather they're going to avoid the use of vegan. It's a term, for all kinds of reasons, that has become almost politicized. So I think they're really focusing on the phrase plant-based. And I think it's important to say that plants, and the plants that will be using these foods, these too will be produced by farmers.
Okay, now let's move on. And who is it is saying that climate change is the greatest threat to public health?
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting development, something that I've been waiting to see for quite some time. We have a consortium of over 200 medical journals. These are the biggest journals in the world dealing with the medical profession. They've come together basically to do a joint editorial. And what they're calling on, what they've described climate change, particularly beyond 1.5 degrees, as the greatest threat to global public health of the 21st century. And they said the science is unequivocal a global increase of 1.5 above pre-industrial, and the continued loss of biodiversity, these risk catastrophic harm to health that will be impossible to reverse. And they make the point that there is no such thing as a safe temperature rise. And I think we've seen that, Matt, even this summer. It's been really been brought home very forcefully. Currently, globally, we're at about plus 1.1, 1.2, and we've seen just how much additional dangerous energy has been put into the global climate system. So we know that once you hit 1.5 and beyond, you're into extremely dangerous territory. And it has been calculated that all the health gains of the last 150 years can be wiped out in the coming decades if we allow climate change to continue on its current pathway. And I think it is really impressive that doctors are rolling up their sleeves and getting involved in it, health professionals. And I say that, Matt, because up until now, it's been people like environmentalists, environmental NGOs, people who you might consider to be on the margin, who've been kind of having to carry this. Now you're seeing very mainstream people, and there's nobody more conservative and mainstream than medical doctors. And also here in Ireland, we have a group called the Irish Doctors for the Environment. They've been doing fantastic work over the last couple of years, and they recognise that there is no use. The medical profession, there's no use simply fishing people out of the river. They need to find out why they're ending up in the river, the metaphorical river, that is, in the first place. And what I mean by that is, with climate change impacts, there isn't enough healthcare in the world to deal with what's coming down the track on this. And also, Matt, very interestingly, last Friday, 60 doctors and nurses in London staged a die-in outside JP Morgan, protesting against that company's use of or its investment in fossil fuels. And these doctors are part of the Extinction Rebellion movement. Now, many people listening to me will say, "Oh, Extinction Rebellion, they're hard cases, they're extremists." These are medical consultants, general practitioners, nurses, family doctors. These are ordinary people who look a lot like me and you, who are so concerned about the climate emergency that they're prepared to go on the streets of London and risk getting arrested. Now, imagine how serious it is for somebody who's worked long and hard to become a medical doctor to risk all of that and in confrontation with the police, that nobody, no health professional wants to be out fighting with the police about stuff like this. But critically, what this report or what this document has said is that they're looking at a whole bunch of direct health consequences here. The obvious one would be heat-related deaths, pregnancy complications, rise in cardiovascular and pulmonary disease, in other words, heart disease and lung disease. Indirectly, Matt, we're looking at the effects of soil depletion leading to an increase in malnutrition, which, of course, has massive health impacts. We're also looking at the health impacts of habitat loss. And the doctors point out that we're looking at more pandemics, that as we're trying to grapple with the devastation of COVID-19, there are more pandemics waiting for us as we continue to clear the natural world and to destroy habitats of wildlife. We're pushing more and more zoonotic diseases in the direction of humanity. So their point is, you know, we've put tremendous resources into dealing with COVID-19, but we could be looking at COVID-25 or COVID-29 if we don't begin to address the global biodiversity crisis, which, of course, is the, if you like, is the evil twin of the global climate crisis.
OK, one last one, and it's linked to that, but you also have details of another study which suggests 90% of the world's remaining coal reserves and 60% of oil and gas reserves should never be extracted. Why not? And what are the chances, do you think, that the countries that are in ownership or the companies in ownership of those reserves will take the blindest bit of notice?
Well, one of those things at a time, right? Well, first of all, this again comes back to exactly as we've just discussed. This comes back to a study that is estimating what we have to do to have just a 50% chance of avoiding exceeding that 1.5 degree threshold, the danger threshold. And as you say, the figures are pretty stark. 90% of the coal in the world can never be burned. 60% of oil and gas. The study broke that down, and they said, for example, they described the conclusions for the report as being bleak for the fossil fuel industry. Now, this is really important, for example, for people who have investments in fossil fuel, people, for example, whose pension funds may be invested in fossil fuel. And I think that's really important, and people should probably start asking that question about, am I invested in fossil fuels? And if so, should I consider whether this is, in fact, is a risky investment? One of the analysts involved at the International Energy Agency, who, Matt, I think we talked about this earlier this year, they brought out a study last May, essentially a similar guidance. And the International Energy Agency, by the way, is essentially the clearinghouse for the energy industry. And that's why their study caused such a fuss. And they basically said that as of 2021, we've got to stop all new fossil fuel developments as much as possible. Now, the second part of your question is, will this happen? Now, I was reading through one of the reports on it, and the Saudi minister, in response to this, he described the International Energy Agency report. He said, quote, "I believe it is a sequel to the movie La La Land," right? So they're obviously regarding it as something that isn't going to happen, certainly not if they have anything to do with it. And I think we have a, if you like, a collision coming here between the irresistible force of, if you like, this gigantic global industry and the immovable object of physical limits in the world. And the two of those are about to collide very soon in the next decade, perhaps, at the 1.5 degree point. And sparks are going to fly, Matt.
Thank you very much, John Gibbons, for joining us for our weekly Environment Spot.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today.